The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
It's The Takeaway for Monday, September 19th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on an unsettling Monday. An explosion in a New York City neighborhood, bombs or knife attacks in 3 states, a manhunt to apprehend the suspect in the weekend bombing in New York City that injured 29 people, ends today with the apprehension of Ahmed Khan Rahami, a 28-year-old man of Afghan descent, a naturalized U.S. citizen who was taken into custody after a shootout with police in Linden, New Jersey. A pressure cooker device similar to the crude explosives used by the Boston bombers years ago was found by investigators in New York over the weekend who secured it for forensic examination, and some of the details and some of what they found led them to the manhunt. A pressure cooker device similar to the crude explosives used by the Boston bombers years ago was found by investigators in New York over the weekend. They secured it for forensic examination, and some of what they found led to today's manhunt and apprehension. A pipe bomb exploded near a Marine Corps race in Seaside, New Jersey. Luckily, no one was injured in that incident, and a connection between the two attacks has reportedly been established. And early today, police and FBI detonated a backpack containing 5 explosives at a train station in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Add to that, in St. Cloud, Minnesota, a man went on a stabbing rampage in the local shopping mall before being shot and killed by law enforcement. ISIS has since claimed responsibility, calling the man a soldier of the Islamic State. This all is a very uneasy backdrop to the meetings of the UN General Assembly this week in New York City, something President Obama spoke about today.
Moments like this, I think it's important to remember what terrorists and violent extremists are trying to do. They are trying to hurt innocent people, but they also want to inspire fear in all of us and disrupt the way we live.
With plenty to think about, we welcome Fred Burton, a former counterterrorism agent with the U.S. State Department and the vice president of intelligence with the geopolitical strategy firm Stratfor. Welcome, Fred.
Thanks for having me on, John.
In a sense, this scenario, this precise scenario, is what you and folks who follow security in the United States have really been waiting for years. Is it starting to emerge as expected?
Well, some would say that the tempo has already emerged, John. Let's not forget Orlando, San Bernardino, Boston, Garland, Texas, Chattanooga, Tennessee. So this tempo doesn't surprise me, I'm afraid. And I think it's the new era that we're living in here in the United States.
But how do you distinguish between something that may have been motivated by a ISIS grafted on excuse for violence that was building within someone, like perhaps the Orlando shooter, perhaps what happened in Chattanooga, and something that is directly commanded by ISIS headquarters, if that is indeed the case with these pressure cooker bombs? The Chechnyans who carried out the Boston bombing, it's still unclear as to whether those motives were commanded from overseas or just were an outgrowth of anger that built within the U.S.?
Well, the model has shifted, John. What we're dealing with today is something we call the leaderless resistance model, where you will have general guidance given out by groups like ISIL or al-Qaeda on the Arabian Peninsula, and they're encouraging these kinds of local attacks. But on a positive note, I expect the New Jersey, New York bomber to be apprehended pretty soon. The whole counterterrorism mission in our post-9/11 world has shifted for these kinds of cases. And the New York, New Jersey JTTFs have a tremendous amount of experience in investigating bombings and hunting down suspects just like this.
Fred, we certainly should be sober about the potential for death and destruction from attacks like these, but should we be concerned about overstatement? I mean, this looks like a fairly ragtag criminal enterprise here that is well within the ability of our security apparatus to deal with, even if there are terrible headlines like we saw on Saturday night.
Well, I think it's a double-edged sword, John. Whenever you have attacks in the New York City area, certainly you're going to have a tremendous amount of media surrounding these events. And you're right. At the end of the day, these are very unsophisticated type of devices that did not kill a lot of people. So on a positive note, you have in all probability the actions of at least one bomb maker, which may or may not have other Confederates with him. So this is the kind of case that I have no doubt that the FBI will resolve pretty quickly.
A couple of words about the stabbing incident in St. Cloud, Minnesota. What do you make of that?
Well, I find that more frightening because much like what we saw in Orlando, you can see how the actions of one person that wants to die can greatly increase your casualty count. And in essence, that's your worst scenario, John. That's what they train you and teach you at your various academies, whether it be the State Department's Diplomatic Security Service Academy or the Secret Service Academy. Especially in a protection environment, if you have an assassin that's willing to die, it's very difficult to stop that kind of attack. And your listeners are not going to want to hear this. But in reality, unless there's intelligence on that assassin before, there's very little you can do to stop that attack from occurring.
Fred Burton is a former counterterrorism agent with the U.S. State Department and vice president of intelligence with the geopolitical strategy firm Stratfor. Fred, thanks so much.
Thank you.
What is going on with U.S. and Russian policy in Syria? A U.S. airstrike mistakenly hit Syrian forces while targeting ISIS over the weekend. The U.S. was quick to come out and admit it was an accident, but Russian leaders seized on the opportunity to suggest that the U.S. was working in the interest of ISIS and called for an emergency security meeting at the Security Council at the United Nations on Saturday night. There was plenty of rhetoric exchanged over all of this on both sides, all of it bitter. Kimberly Martin is a professor of political science at Barnard College and Columbia University. First of all, I thought the Syrian government was the enemy of the United States and that we wanted to see Bashar al-Assad removed from power. Why are we apologizing for a hit on government forces?
Oh, John, it's complicated. We have not said that the Syrian government is the enemy. We have not been targeting the Syrian government. We have been targeting the Islamic State. And there's a question about whether that target list is going to expand now with this potential cooperation with Russia. But I think it's important to keep in mind that there's so many complex players involved in Syria. It's not just a U.S.-Russia deal. And that, in fact, there is some evidence that the strike was carried out accidentally, not by the U.S. itself, but by a member of the U.S. coalition, namely Australia. So we don't yet know the details.
And Australia has denied that it is it was motivated to attack Russian-sponsored surrogates in Syria. So there's all kinds of confusion from the Australian angle here. Can the U.S. in a confused place as Syria sort out the difference between al-Nusra and ISIS and the government forces and still maintain a relationship that could produce a ceasefire in Syria?
I think a lot of people are doubting that at this point the ceasefire that was worked out is going to hold. Just to give some backstory for what happened in the United Nations Security Council, on Friday there was supposed to be a meeting of the UN Security Council to talk about this U.S.-Russia agreement, and Russia canceled the meeting at the last minute because the United States didn't want to go public about all the details of the U.S.-Russian cooperation. So we have to keep in mind that that is the backstory of what happened over the weekend when there was the anger over Russia now calling the UN Security Council meeting and blaming the United States and saying that it actually supported the Islamic State.
So the U.S. and Russia working together, the U.S. does not want that to be known. The government forces in Syria are tight with the Russians, and the Russians don't want them attacked. The ceasefire has been declared clinically dead by the Turks, who are moving tanks across the border into Syria. Where does the ceasefire stand at this point?
Well, I don't think it's that the U.S. doesn't want to know the arrangement, the existence of the arrangement to be known. That's been made public. It just didn't want the details about the targeting to be known. And apparently Russia wanted to release more details that the United States wanted to keep at a classified level. So that was that issue. But keep in mind that something else happened over the weekend, too, which is that there was the parliamentary election that happened in Russia. And the results seemed to be that, you know, big surprise, Putin's party got 75% of the vote. We know political scientists have a technical term for getting 75% of the vote, which is ridiculous. That was not a free and fair election. And so it would not be surprising to me if the statements about how actually the U.S. is supporting the Islamic State in Syria were designed for a domestic audience to try to further Putin's message that the U.S. is out to get Russia and that only by keeping him in power can Russia reestablish its strength as a great power.
But even though all you brilliant political scientists up there at Barnard and in the academies here in the United States can call it a ridiculous election, isn't it true to say that on the ground in Russia there is a strong consensus that legislatures and democratic institutions are not preferred to the simple sort of autocratic cult leadership of Vladimir Putin right now, that they feel security comes from him more than it comes from the squabbling at lower levels?
Well, I think the evidence indicates that intellectuals and people who tend to really be following world events on their own probably did not vote in the Russian election. Mm. The participation rate was, you know, not any higher than what we see in U.S. elections. And so, yes, I think you're right that of the people who did vote, Putin's base is tend to be people in rural areas who are workers and pensioners. And yes, I think they do like the idea of having a strong czar in place. Not surprisingly, what we just learned this morning is that following this 75% vote, two different Russian press sources reported that it looks like the centralized KGB is being established again in Moscow before the 2018 presidential election that's coming up. They've changed the name. It'll be a ministry, an MGB of state security rather than the KGB, the Committee of State Security. But we're going back to the way things used to be and maybe even stronger.
The good old days in Russia. Finally, before we go, you said that the details of targeting were what the U.S. did not want known. Is it possible that this mistake here was a mistake of communication between the U.S. that's supposed to notify the Russians over what it's attacking in Syria as part of this strange and difficult to maintain targeting arrangement?
Well, I think the communication problem could also be on the other side. We don't have enough information to know, but it could be that Russia did not make clear exactly where they had information about the Syrian forces versus the Islamic State sources. Certainly, there is a breakdown of communication, and I think there's a lot of distrust on both sides, especially within the Pentagon, that is not happy about the arrangement from what we know.
And Secretary of State John Kerry is not having a good day today. Fair to say.
Yes, it's not a good day for U.S.-Russia cooperation today.
Kimberly Martin is a professor of political science at Barnard College and Columbia University. And by the way, a very somber-sounding Secretary of State Kerry called the Syrian ceasefire fragile but holding, while the Syrian government said today it was over.
The Takeaway is supported by Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag-and-drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at ConstantContact.com. And Staples, with copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom-framed prints and posters. More at Staples Stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
It's being called the United Nations Summit for Refugees and Migrants. It's being held in New York today as part of the ongoing meetings of the UN General Assembly. Can heads of state and governments come up with a humane international response to the migrant and refugee issue amidst a very tense city? Tomorrow, President Obama will host the Leaders' Summit on Refugees on the sidelines of the meetings, following the news last week that the administration plans to increase the number of refugees admitted in the U.S. to 110,000 in the new fiscal year beginning in October. Alex Oleynikov is former U.N. Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees from 2010 to 2015. Teferi Gebre is an activist and immigrant success story. He's a former political refugee from Ethiopia, now Executive Vice President of the AFL-CIO, and he will be speaking at the U.N. General Assembly today. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's very Gebreyesus. If a country can't govern its people and they move somewhere else, someone's going to have to take up that job. And it seems that the international community is uniquely not ready for what's going on right now.
That's very true. We tend to do the very minimum instead of trying to do the maximum. And some of the other stuff that people don't know about is a lot of migration happens on basis of exploitation. These are people who are promised the heavens and they walk into hell when they migrate. You know, people like myself, you know, we just don't get up one day and just say, I'm just going to leave my country. There are conditions that are creating for people to abandon where they grow up in, where they lived in, and go to unknown places.
Tell me a little bit about your personal story, because you've gone from being an Ethiopian citizen, if I'm not mistaken,
yes,
to being a refugee,
yes,
to now being a vice president, executive vice president of the AFL-CIO union here in the United States. Mm-hmm. Is that trajectory part of the narrative of what's going on in the world, defending refugees is no different than defending workers in the 21st century?
That's absolutely right. But the pathway I had, I don't know if that pathway still exists for millions of others. You know, xenophobia is on that prize, not only here in the United States, but also in Europe. On the other hand, there are stories that are not being told of the contributions that refugees have to host countries. You know, I believe I have not been a burden to this country. Instead, I have been a blessing to this country. And there are millions like me who are contributing, who are building our bridges, who are our engineers, who are healing the sick as doctors, who left uncomfortable situations in their homeland and, you know, they found a new home. And we should receive them with open hands instead of fearing them and calling them terrorists and calling them whatever name that people think of.
The system of nation states that emerged in the 20th century is often cited as a mechanism for peace in the world. But it also seems that in the 21st century, that system of nation states allows nations to, on the one hand, say, I'm raising my flag for my people. But when some other folks come to the border, they all of a sudden say, hey, not those folks, that all of a sudden the nation state becomes an argument for exclusion rather than peace and inclusion. How do you fix something like that, Alex?
That's a really good question. After World War II, the world did come together and adopted a convention on refugees, and UNHCR, the refugee agency, was created. And through that system, millions of lives have been saved and advanced. The world did come together. One of the things that was left out of the agreements in the 1950s was some kind of global responsibility-sharing mechanism. So states committed to respecting the rights of refugees in their country. But the world didn't get together and say, when there is a massive refugee flow, we will do the following. And the Syrian situation is a very good example of that, where you, as I said, 4.5 million Syrian refugees, but there hasn't been an international conference saying, how are we going to share out the responsibilities of these people? And it's been left to the states on the borders of Syria rather than being globally shared.
You're going to speak at the UN General Assembly. What's your message?
My message is trying to actually put a perspective, a personal perspective, on who refugees are. I don't have to tell you this. The political climate here in our own country is very unsettling. I want to guarantee and warn everyone who's listening to me right now, there is a huge, rigorous process of actually weeding out anything you suspect from coming into this country. We have a blessing in this country that we are not a border country where Syrians or anybody you suspect actually can walk in. We get to go to a refugee camp and actually we go pick and choose who we want to bring into this country. And, you know, honestly, the people who are pumping this up for political reasons know that.
What's the mission of this summit meeting and how can it mobilize efforts to fight precisely the suspicion that Tafari is talking about?
The impetus for the summit was the massive flow of migrants and refugees to Europe over the last couple of years, but the goals are far broader. It goes to the system as a whole. The summit documents that will come out that the General Assembly adopt will say good things about the rights of migrants, human rights of migrants. Anti-xenophobia campaigns are necessary, reaffirming the commitments of the Refugee Convention to protect refugees. It's a bit short on specific commitments as to what will happen after. It will provide for a two-year UN process to now come up with a compact on refugees and a compact on migrants. And I think that's where the real work will start, and that's where the work has to start on both increasing assistance to hosting states and to refugees, but more importantly, coming up with these global systems for responsibility sharing that will take a system that has bred long-term dependency for millions of refugees around the world and try to produce a system that allows them to effectively rebuild their lives.
Alex Alenikoff is former UN Deputy High Commissioner for Refugees, currently a senior fellow at the Migration Policy Institute and a visiting professor of law at Columbia University. Alex, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And Tevere Gebre is a former political refugee from Ethiopia, now a proud executive vice president of the AFL-CIO right here in America. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
There are communities south of the U.S.-Mexican border which are as lawless and war-torn as some of the war-torn communities in Syria. The U.S.-Mexico drug war, in which U.S. demand for drugs brings cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and methamphetamine north in return for weapons and money that flows south to fuel a war over power between the government and the cartels. According to the official numbers, some 27,000 people have disappeared in Mexico since 2007. Mexico's weak judicial system is simply overwhelmed by drug-related crimes. Witnesses like filmmaker Bernardo Ruiz say victims and their families are locked in a conflict in which violence is everywhere and safety nowhere. Ruiz's new POV documentary, airing on PBS, is called Kingdom of Shadows.
For me, it wasn't so much a narco film as it was another film in my interrogation of the U.S.-Mexico relationship. And so what I wanted to do in the film was just really do something very simple in a way, and that is to look at how this conflict that's claimed so many lives, how it's impacted the lives of three people on the front lines of the war.
And, you know, in the Monterrey territory, one of the most brutal places in this whole conflict, where it's all about the war between the Zetas and the Gulf cartel, right in the middle of that is one of your main characters. Tell me about her.
She's Sister Consuelo Morales, who's this dogged human rights defender. What I love about her is that she's not just a kind of heroic, two-dimensional person. She's this very complex woman who is standing down either corrupt officials or officials who are not doing their jobs in investigating the disappearance of citizens of Monterrey. A local journalist in Monterrey had a kind of perfect way to describe her. He describes her as a combination of tenderness and fury. She's someone who's consoling and accompanying the family members as they look for answers of their disappeared. And she's also pushing state officials to do something about the disappeared.
Generalmente, la gente tiene alguien.
Almost everyone knows someone who's gone missing, and they know that this person wasn't involved in organized crimes. The vast majority are women looking for their loved ones. They are wives, mothers, daughters, sisters.
Who were the disappeared, and how does Sister Morales help them?
Well, you know, according to Amnesty, there are at least 27,000 disappeared since 2007. It's roughly the period when the former president of Mexico, Felipe Calderón, took power and declared this frontal war on organized crime groups. But of course, many activists and journalists believe that number to be much higher. In the case of Monterrey, as you described, there was this turf war between the Gulf Cartel, which is a more traditional, old-school organized crime entity, and the Zetas, who were their former enforcers, who essentially defected and formed a rival organization. That bloody turf war resulted in the deaths and disappearance of countless Monterrey citizens. Oftentimes, it's people being in the wrong place at the wrong time, in a place where there's this climate of fear and general impunity. You know, if you're texting someone on your phone, you could simply be texting someone, or you could be a lookout for a rival organized crime group. So what we saw in Monterrey in the period right after I filmed was hundreds of people, thousands according to the organization that Consuelo worked with, disappear. And in many cases, organized crime left no trace.
Is part of this the realization that in the 21st century, it's not just the drugs that have the power or the money that, you know, has the power. It's the guns.
I think there's no question that the arms travel south, the drugs flow north. You know, the U.S. is the largest market for illicit narcotics in the world, according to many different people. But I think more than arms, it's also the question of training. You know, fascinatingly, the Zetas, you know, their core members were people who defected from the Mexican military, from an elite unit in the Mexican military, some of whom received training in the United States. That's very well documented.
Well, one of the facts that you talk about that this film tries to illuminate is presented by an employee of U.S. Homeland Security in El Paso, Texas.
We, as Americans, you know, tend to look at Mexico as, oh, you know, those guys are flooding our streets with drugs and they're flooding our economy with illicit money. But, you know, you really wouldn't have that problem if there wasn't demand. We're the country with the highest consumption of illegal narcotics in the world. And so we have a lot to do with that, too.
Who is that speaking?
That's a Homeland Security investigator, Oscar Hagelsieb, who's, a resident of the border. His parents crossed the U.S.-Mexico border without papers, and he was born in the U.S. as a U.S. citizen, actually joined the Border Patrol and began deporting people just like his parents, but was a very effective agent as an undercover person. He's one of the guardians of the border. He's one of the people who is patrolling the border and at one point infiltrating organized crime groups in the northern Mexican region.
Your film was backed by a stakeholder in this whole conflict. Tell me that story.
So one of my executive producers is Jimena Martí, and her brother was kidnapped in 2008. She comes from a prominent, wealthy Mexican family. Her father is a sporting goods chain magnate. And when her younger brother was kidnapped, the family had the resources to pay a very large ransom. Despite paying this ransom, the boy was not returned. And a few weeks after paying the ransom, his body was discovered in the trunk of a vehicle in Mexico City, a really horrific event. Jimena Martí, my executive producer, and the rest of her family got together and said, if this is what's happening to us, and we are so well connected, and we really do have resources, what's happening to ordinary citizens in Mexico?
What does she say to you a film like this can possibly achieve?
I think the biggest issue is looking at the interconnected relationship between the U.S. and Mexico and the way in which harm can be generated when we're not paying attention. It's so funny, we're in an election season. You know, once again, the U.S.-Mexico border and Mexico has become a kind of punching bag. And there are lots of emotional arguments. But if we go back to a kind of fact-based discussion and we just acknowledge the reality of the relationship between the two countries, you know, Mexico is the third largest trading partner of the U.S. 10% of the U.S. population claims heritage to Mexico. You know, these ties are not going to be ripped apart. So if we start looking at what is really happening, what the connections actually are, we might then begin to think about ways to strengthen human rights in Mexico and maybe talk about the market for illicit narcotics as a, you know, thinking about it as a public health issue here in the United States.
Bernardo Ruiz is director of Kingdom of Shadows, a POV offering on PBS stations. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Kingdom of Shadows airs tonight on PBS's POV series. Check your local listings. Can the Obama administration make good on a promise to reverse segregated housing patterns in America that are a shameful legacy of the incomplete civil rights movement? Our friends at Retro Report report on some efforts to end housing discrimination back in the 1960s that moved black families into white suburbs only to discover intolerance was already part of the neighborhood. The Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. discovered this on a trip to Chicago back in 1966.
Back to the jungle, you guys! Back to the jungle, go! Will you?
No, they're all black.
Don't ever come back.
I have never seen, even in Mississippi and Alabama, a mob as hostile and as hate-filled as I've seen in Chicago.
It would take another decade and a court order before black residents sequestered in public housing towers on the south side of Chicago could apply for vouchers to rent in middle-class white neighborhoods. Scott Michaels, Retro Report producer, reminds us of just how controversial it was to challenge housing policy in the industrial north in the 1960s.
1966 was the year when Martin Luther King came to Chicago, and the big issue that he was trying to deal with was segregated housing and segregated neighborhoods. And that sound, I think, very dramatically shows you the hostility from the white suburban areas around Chicago to the idea that African Americans could potentially move into their neighborhoods and become their neighbors.
I would go out in the morning to get in my car, and there would be rotten eggs thrown on the windshield and all over the car. The girls would tell me that people would call them names. They would call them nigger, baboon.
This woman by the name of Valencia Morris. How did you find her, and how did she contribute to your report?
Ms. Morris was in a housing mobility program in Chicago that started in the 1970s. And basically what it did was it gave vouchers to people who lived in the Chicago housing projects, African-American families, and helped them move to private apartments in the suburbs. But the catch was you had to live in a predominantly white middle-class neighborhood in the suburbs. And we spoke with Ms. Morris and a number of other families who were in the program who often were one of the only or maybe the only minority family in the entire community. And generally what they said was that they didn't always feel very welcome there.
Was this a successful program? And did it scale to the point where it really changed the numbers and the segregation battle lines in a city like Chicago?
I mean, it's a small program compared to the size of the problem, right? So there were about 7,000 families total. A number of them dropped out essentially and moved back to Chicago, I think in large part because of the feelings of hostility and isolation that you talked about. But for the people who stayed in the program, the research has shown that they did much better than people who stayed back in the projects in terms of earning more money and doing better in school and going to college.
Did this program and the limited success that it had become an argument for the dismantling of Cabrini-Green and the Robert Taylor homes and the huge centralized, concentrated apartment buildings that were the signature of the Chicago Housing Authority in this time?
It did. So the program was the outcome of a lawsuit called Gautreau, which was really the first major civil rights lawsuit to try to deal with segregated public housing. That lawsuit also officially brought an end to segregated public housing in the city. And it meant that if the city of Chicago was going to build new public housing in African-American neighborhoods, it was also going to have to start building housing in white or racially mixed neighborhoods.
Scott Michaels, Retro Report producer, reports on efforts to desegregate public housing in the city of Chicago back in the 1960s. Scott, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Imagine a cafe on the Lower East Side of Manhattan, smoky, noisy. This is the winter of 1917, New York City.
One of Trotsky's favorite cafes was the Monopole Cafe on 2nd Avenue in Lower New York, around 8th or 9th Street. And if you walked into it today, it was very reminiscent of cafes in Vienna or Paris. There would be people at tables, card tables, people drinking, foreign languages, probably pierogies and latkes and herrings, and people drinking schnapps and people haggling over politics. That's what they did.
That's historian Kenneth Ackerman, whose book Trotsky in New York, 1917, tells the story of a radical America largely forgotten today. Leon Trotsky lived in a working-class tenement in the Bronx and roamed the politically active streets of immigrant-crowded New York. He wrote for the socialist literary magazine Novi Mir, was a celebrity active in local politics, an ally of socialist presidential candidate Eugene Debs. But for the 3 months he was in New York, his words and movements were watched with great attention all over the world.
Well, New York City in 1917 was a very different place. It was in a lot of ways, it felt like a foreign country. You had large, vast, literally vast neighborhoods where people didn't speak English, where the food was all European food. You had large numbers of people who were literally straight off the boat, people who were born on the other side of the ocean and came here. There have been vast waves of immigration since the middle 1800s. And so in New York City, there were some 500,000 Russians, 300,000 Italians, 200,000 Irish, and so on down the list.
It was an immigration kaleidoscope,
yes,
with a politics to match.
Yes. The politics were very different than today. I mean, yes, Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party, was the strongest voice in the city, but they competed for power with the Socialist Party. And socialism itself was at a high point in America and had many different forms, all the ways from the radical anarchists under Emma Goldman to the radical labor movement under the IWW, Big Bill Haywood. And the biggest movement was the Socialist Party of America, which within itself had many feuding factions ranging from the more moderate Morris Hillquit to the more radical Leon Trotsky.
And Trotsky himself was not unlike maybe a member of the Rolling Stones. If there was a Trotsky sighting, it ended up in discussions at coffee houses and even in the newspapers.
Around the world,
yep.
Yes.
Right.
Trotsky was very much a celebrity within this small circle of radicals who had outposts literally in every city. Most of them Russian emigres. People had been leaving Russia since the 1880s because of persecution. Trotsky was known as the one who had been arrested, sent to Siberia twice, and escaped twice.
What was his influence here, and what was his platform here that tried to influence matters in Moscow?
Well, when Trotsky landed, he very quickly got drawn in because there was a brewing fight within the New York leftist world at the moment he landed in January 1917, and it all had to do with World War I. Europe at this point was in its third year of World War I, a terrible experience. More than 10 million people had been killed so far. And there was a feeling of pointlessness about World War I that we tend to forget today. We tend to confuse it with World War II, the good war. World War I was widely viewed as a squabble among kings and capitalists. At that point, America had stayed out. We had benefited from it. We were having a cultural grand period, Broadway, the movies.
Gilded Age.
The Gilded Age, right. of the Grand Epoque.
And Europe was slaughtering itself over, yes, this squabble of kings and capitalists.
Correct. And at that point, America was just teetering on the verge of getting in. And the question within the left wing, the socialists, the New York immigrants, who all hated the war for a lot of different reasons, was what do we do if America goes in? Do we act as patriots and defend the country, or do we fight it to the hilt?
And with the discussion of Vladimir Putin in mind in today's election campaign, mm-hmm, how do we gauge the extent to which America was bound up in the debates in Moscow of the 1917-1918 period?
Moscow itself was a very different place, and St. Petersburg was a very different place back then. In early 1917, Russia was ruled by the Tsar, very autocratic leader. And most of the dissidents had left the country. They were either pushed out or sent to Siberia or had escaped at some point. And so there was a great interaction between the social democratic movement around the world and dissidents within Russia. They went under a lot of different names, Bolsheviks, Mensheviks. The group was very fractured. But when the chance came to actually overthrow the system and actually create a revolution in Russia, when the first wave of the revolution started in March 1917 with the Tsar being overthrown, radicals around the world started running home. They thought this was their chance to finally achieve socialism, something they had all talked about in an abstract way up until then.
America was not on the side of the autocrat in this,
correct,
discussion, the Tsar. It was on the side of the revolution.
Yes. And this is another thing that we tend to forget today, because the way the story turns out is communism ends up winning in Russia, which we were against. For the interim period, when the Tsar was overthrown in Russia, we were all for it. The Tsar was a hated figure around the world. He was reviled by virtually all the immigrants in America who had come fleeing persecution. He was the major reason why we couldn't enter World War I, because there was so much ill feeling for him.
So Leon Trotsky would view the commentary about Putin being a great leader by a presidential candidate as being outrageous.
Yeah.
You would even recognize this kind of discussion.
Correct. Correct. For Trotsky, and again, his later life is very controversial, but at this point, he wanted to see socialism. And socialism at that point, Trotsky was what you called a Menshevik. He would become a Bolshevik later. But Mensheviks believed that socialism would be achieved through a mass movement, a democratic movement of people taking power.
Would Bernie Sanders and Leon Trotsky, there might be some language barriers, but would they share a meal together if intervening time was suddenly swept away?
They would share a meal together, but they'd probably be fighting after the first appetizer.
Arguing over what? Over what?
Trotsky represented the radical fringe of even within the socialist movement at the time. Bernie Sanders would represent the democratic socialist wing, the people who felt that revolution was more of a metaphor, that you achieve socialism by winning elections and passing reforms through legislatures. He was represented at the time by a man named Morris Hillquit, who was the head of the Socialist Party, who tried to make the Socialist Party part of the American mainstream by electing congressmen and mayors and state legislators, that kind of thing.
And they all would have viewed the Donald Trumps of the world as capitalists and kings, and Hillary Clinton as a member of the establishment who would probably never be seen on the streets where Trotsky and Sanders would have coffee.
Correct. Correct. Huh. Yes, they would view Donald Trump as the archenemy, as a capitalist. They would view Hillary Clinton. They viewed Woodrow Wilson as the tool of the capitalist leadership of the country.
So what are the lessons of Trotsky's attempt to create a socially responsible revolution in Russia that failed?
Mm-hmm.
Is he viewed today as a moderate who had a brief moment of impact in the United States, or is he part of the dustbin of history, as Stalin would say?
Unfortunately, he's because socialism failed in Russia and communism failed in Russia, and Trotsky was kicked out by Stalin. He became a dissident even within his own movement. He is largely forgotten today, and that's a shame, particularly within Russia, where the Stalinist era literally erased him from the country's history. He's very little known among younger people. But he is still today considered the radical of the radicals. He is the one who is always pushing for change. He is the one who would not be satisfied with the status quo. He became a Menshevik when being a Menshevik was the most radical thing to be. He became a Bolshevik when he got back to Russia and realized that the more moderate Mensheviks were never going to take power. He realized the compromise didn't work. Once he was in power, once the communists did take over, he found that he couldn't deal with them. He couldn't deal with their autocracy, with their controlling bureaucracy. So he was always kind of a half a step ahead, and that often put him on the outs.
His end, of course, in Mexico,
yes.
Right? In controversial circumstances that we don't fully know today, right?
Well, it's largely understood that he was killed by an agent on orders of Joseph Stalin,
right.
That the NKVD set up an agent through their local affiliate in Mexico, a man named Raymond Mercader, who insinuated himself into the Trotsky circle, pretended that he was an ally, got access to his office, and attacked him with an ice pick.
Kenneth Ackerman is author of Trotsky in New York, 1917, A Radical on the Eve of Revolution. And here's something to take with you today. As Professor Kimberly Martin reminded us earlier this hour, another sign of the good old days of the Cold War may be on the way back. Fresh from a new endorsement from voters in parliamentary elections, a reliable business journal says the Russian government will resurrect the KGB, one of the most discredited institutions of the Soviet era. It will now be called the MGB. Well, that should fix it. No official comment yet, and apparently part of the holdup is finding the money to buy out the lucrative contracts of existing security police in Russia. Life after the KGB is apparently very lucrative. Just look at one of its most famous undercover former employees, President Vladimir Putin. Subscribe to the Takeaway Podcast on iTunes. Give us a rating. Again, you can find us on iTunes or on your favorite podcast app. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. Glad to be back. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Audible, provider of audiobooks on topics ranging from astronomy to zombies. More at audible.com/listen. Audible, stories that surround you. Curious.com, working to help people reclaim between 5 and 30 minutes a day to learn something new and build their CQ or curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. More at curious.com/PRI. Constant Contact, offering email marketing features like drag and drop editing and mobile-friendly templates. Constant Contact's products are focused on helping small businesses. More at constantcontact.com. The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.